Welcome to Preaching Podcasts. For those who proclaim publicly, this is a weekly podcast from the Stevenson School of Ministry, where we take a look at the lectionary from diverse and unique perspectives to help prepare church leaders, preachers, pundits, proclaimers, teachers for Sunday worship. I'm your host, Deirdre Good, and with me today is Josh Davis and Julian Sheffield.
Hello, everyone. Hello, Julian. Welcome.
Hello, Josh. Hello, Deirdre.
Wonderful, wonderful to be with you both. Julian, welcome to our little preaching podcast. We're so pleased you could be here, and I'll explain why you're here in a minute. So Althea couldn't be here with us this week. She has, as people do over the Easter break, she is doing some other things with family. And we are going to be taking a look at readings for the second Sunday of Easter. And we're in the Easter season, the glorious 50 days of Easter, and we are right after, we're running up against Easter itself, and this is the second Sunday of Easter, and the readings are nothing from the Hebrew Bible. We've got Psalm 133, which is, I like to think of this in light of the Easter season, that is to say, dwelling together in a world where resurrection is possible. In the world where death is overcome and nothing is foreclosed in terms of possibilities. Psalm 133, how good it, pleasant it is when brethren live together in unity. It's like, Josh, you can relate to this, fine oil upon the head that runs down upon the beard. I'm sure that's a customary practice of yours. Maybe, you know.
Right. Not something that cooking. I can personally relate to, but I get the idea. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great image. So we then we follow in the collect the idea of the establishing the new covenant of reconciliation in the Paschal mystery. And we are requesting that all who've been reborn into the fellowship of Christ's body may show forth in their lives what they profess by their faith. So this whole set of readings is about celebrating the Easter season. And also, it's also about profession. And we certainly see profession in the statement in Acts, which describes early believers, early Jesus followers in Jerusalem. The whole group is of one heart and soul. No one claimed private ownership of any possessions. Everything owned everything in common. And they all attest to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and great grace was upon them all. Nobody amongst them or outside was needy, because those who had property sold and brought the proceeds of what was sold laid it at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to all who had need. This is a kind of idyllic example of common living in the days after Easter. Why not? I'm going to say that Julian is here because she and I are married, and we attend our local Episcopal Church together here in Waldo County in Maine. And we have been part of a group that is training lay catechists, lay preachers and worship leaders of morning prayer in our parish. And she has just been working on a sermon for this very Sunday. So if we just look at the gospel, I'm going to, let Julian explain what her sermon is about and what she's doing. But this passage of John 20, 19 to 31 comes up every year in the lectionary cycle because it's Easter too, and this is the reading for Easter too. So if you've heard it once, you've heard it several times. I'm not going to talk much about it. I'm going to hand this over. Julian, can you say something about the process by which you thought of an approach to the sermon, and maybe some of your emphases, and then Josh will pick up on that because he's not, like me, heard the sermon. So can you do that? Thank you. Great to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be with you two wonderful scholars. And I'm just a little layperson here doing my thing. So this passage has just been a favorite of mine for a really long time because I really love Thomas. I love Thomas. Probably not quite as much as Thomas loved Jesus, but there it is. I love Thomas, and I love trying to work through what's going on in his head. Remember, he's the one who says, back in, I think I mean chapter 11, he says, when Jesus says, let's go to Bethany. Well, remember that Jesus has just gotten away from being stoned there. Mm-hmm. And so Thomas says, okay, he's going to go. Let us go too and die with him, because that's what's going to happen. He's sort of the Eeyore of the New Testament, you know. He's realistic. He's logistical. He says in chapter 14, he says, when Jesus says, look, I'm gonna go make a really splendid place for you to come and be with me. And Thomas says, how are we going to do that? We have no idea where this place is. How are we possibly going to come and be with you there? We don't know how to get there. He's the totally logical, realistic, hard-nosed person. But that line, let us go and die with him, that is a disciple who loves his Lord in a way that I think is beyond any kind of loving. So I look at this passage from that perspective, and I try to understand what it meant to love your Lord that much. And the first thing you see is that on that first evening, he's not there. So where was he? What was he doing? Why was he not there? How did he feel when he came back and he discovered this Lord that he loved, that he was willing to go and die for, had come and been amongst them? What must that have felt like? Of all the disciples, he was the one willing to go and die with Jesus. And yet Jesus didn't reveal himself to him. He was left out. So, he's been through heart-wrenching experience of Jesus' death. He's been through the morning news that Jesus was sighted. But remember, he is very realistic. And he heard it as everybody else did. And so he has this flicker of hope. He was practical. So he remembered everything Jesus said. But he wasn't there. So it's not terribly surprising that he says, okay, he showed you, Jesus showed you his hands and his feet, but that is not going to be enough for me. I'm going to need a little more than that. I'm going to need to put my finger in the mark in his hand. I'm going to need to put my hand in his side before I believe. So, in terms of my process was to try to get inside Thomas, given the details of the text I've been given, which, you know, you have what's there, that he showed them his hands and his side, and you have Thomas's reaction, and then you have to think through, what did that mean to him? What did that mean to him from what we know of him previously in the gospel? And I think I'm going to stop there and let Josh speak.
I love this idea, Julian. I love what you're exploring here. And it's caused me to think about several things. And I'd love to ask you about them. I'm thinking particularly about this idea that you point to, that which I think is so such attentive reading of the text, that of all the disciples, Thomas is the one that's ready and willing to go and die. And I mean, the Gospels present us figures like Peter who, you know, they center Peter in particular for his unwillingness to accept what's coming for Jesus. And I think there's a way to understand Judas Judas's actions as well, like a rejection of where all this is going. And here you have Thomas, who's absolutely committed to this, and yet has the reputation on the other side of the resurrection for being the one that doubts. What do you make of that? I think this is just wonderful the way you've highlighted this.
Well, Josh, I've done a lot of thinking about these resurrection appearances. And, you know, Thomas wasn't the only one who had a question.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to look at these resurrection appearances because here's the thing. Right at the beginning of this particular passage, Jesus is not recognized, even though he pops in out of nowhere and mm-hmm. through a locked door. He's not recognized.
Mm-hmm.
Until he shows them his hands and his side.
Mm.
So the disciples there weren't believing. Mm-hmm. They weren't expecting it. They weren't paying very much attention to what Mary had said in the morning. Mm-hmm. You know, she's only a woman, after all. she's probably hysterical. So not only then, but if you look later on, if you jump over and look into the following chapter, I think it's 21, chapter 21, they don't recognize him on the beach either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have a whole conversation. He has to call out to them, hey, put your net down on the other side. And it isn't until all these fish start popping up that one of them says, oh, it's the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
They don't see him. Jesus's face is not recognizable. And it's not just in John that it's not recognizable. It's not recognizable in Luke. These disciples take a long walk all the way down to Ephrata to long conversation, start to have a meal with somebody they don't recognize
mm-hmm.
until he breaks bread. So, and then he, at that point, he disappears and he pops back up again, a couple hours later after they've walked back to report. And they still don't recognize him again. He looks different. He's a stranger. First time he was a stranger. This time he's even stranger because they don't recognize him again
mm-hmm.
until he eats with them and proves that he's actually back. So these resurrection appearances have nothing to do with being able to identify somebody from their face.
Yeah.
The recognition of who Jesus was comes when Jesus reveals it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only seen by looking very intently. So I think that Thomas's reputation as doubting is vastly overestimated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, everybody was doubting. He wasn't the only one. He just made the loudest noise about it.
Right. And so what's more significant, which is the other thing that I was going to ask you about, so what would be more significant than his being a doubter here is the fact that he's excluded from the original appearance, or that he's not there.
That's my feeling, yes.
Yeah.
And I feel that Jesus makes a special point of speaking to him. He knows how Thomas feels when he comes that second time, that night that Thomas is there.
Mm-hmm.
He knows that heart has been broken.
Mm-hmm.
And he reaches out to him. And you have to note that Thomas doesn't put his finger. Thomas doesn't put his hand in the side. He says, "My Lord and my God." He recognizes him just from the fact that Jesus is speaking to him.
That's such an extraordinary insight, Julian, because it goes against the grain of the way that we've been conditioned to read that story. In fact, he doesn't actually do it. He recognizes him immediately as soon as he is present to see him. That's really
well,
striking.
Well, actually, nobody recognizes him immediately when he's present. It isn't until Jesus speaks to them.
Right.
And speaks to him particularly.
Right.
I mean, Thomas doesn't say, "Oh, my Lord and my God," the minute Jesus says peace.
Yeah.
It isn't until after he speaks directly to Thomas that they all realize who he is.
Right.
And, you know, that's quite astonishing, because that means he didn't just look a little bit like himself or a little bit not like himself. Because they've got to be getting used to having him pop in and out.
Right. But right? the others don't recognize that he's the one that's present until he speaks directly to Thomas.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Julian, didn't you have a point about wounds and scars also? I mean, your point is that something about identity and wounds and scars.
Well, I feel that this is one of the crucial things here. It is the wounds, it is the scars that reveal Jesus to the disciples gathered together and to Thomas. It's also the speaking. But what I was saying when I put my sermon together was the wounds provide the light of Christ. The wounds provide the light by which you see the resurrected Jesus. And at the end of the gospel for the day, Jesus says, "Blessed are you who have not seen and yet have believed." And that's to us. That's directly to us. Mm-hmm. It's not disparaging Thomas. Mm-hmm. It's understanding that there's going to be generations of people who will only see the resurrected Jesus by the light of his wounds. If you go further then into Acts, you find a place where Peter and John meet a cripple on the steps of the temple. And in that passage, they look intently at him. And I just have this feeling that after all these appearances of completely unrecognizable resurrected Jesuses, they've learned to look intently with the hope that perhaps the resurrected Jesus is appearing again. The risen Lord is there in the person they're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
In the wounds of others. That in each other's wounds, if we look at each other with the eyes that are lighted by the light of Christ's wounds, if we look at each other, we will see the risen Lord in the other's wounds. Mm.
This reference that you're alluding to is in Acts 3. Verse 4, when Peter and John are about to go into the temple, and there's a person who can't walk at the beautiful gate asking alms for those who are entering the temple. And Peter looks intently at him, as did John, and says, "Look at us." And he fixed his attention on them, you know, for a different reason than perhaps Peter is looking at him. He might be expecting alms. And he's looking at Peter and John as strangers, but they are looking at him also as somebody on whom they should fix their attention. So
somebody who might be the risen Lord if they look close enough.
I think in this resurrected season, that's certainly something to keep in mind as an emphasis from Gospels like John and also passages like Acts, because Acts is unique in the sense that it is the only text that talks about life after the resurrection. Luke has written a two-volume work, and Acts is about the expansion of the gospel after the stories of Jesus' resurrection appearances and the expansion of Jerusalem, the Jerusalem community from Jerusalem to the ends of the earth.
There's the other thing that strikes me about the way you're describing seeing the risen Lord in the wounds of others is this would connect with the disciples. The ambiguity of who this person is that's speaking to them in the resurrection appearances, right? Like they don't recognize him immediately, and then they do, and they yes. do when he speaks to them. And is there an aspect to seeing the wounds of others and hearing Christ speak to you? Is that anything that you've thought about in relationship to this?
That's a wonderful thought, Josh, and I haven't thought about that at all, to be perfectly honest. What I've mostly thought about is what the world would be like if every time we saw a stranger, we looked for the wounds, expecting to see the risen Christ.
Right. To hear his voice.
To hear his voice.
Yeah.
There's another angle on this, which is the role that Thomas plays in community. Thomas appears in chapters 11 and 14 at the point at which Jesus is engaged in the last extended dialogue he will have before he dies, amongst and with the disciples, the followers. So that's where we first encounter Thomas, but we also encounter other disciples like Philip, and they have little roles in the dialogue. But John has created this dialogue framework, and there are plenty of scholars and readers of texts after the time and during the time of the New Testament who have noticed that they are copying the model of the dialogue amongst Jesus and the disciples and placing it now in a resurrection setting so that there's a long extension of Jesus' time after death in resurrection with a community of disciples that is a disclosure of meaning by the resurrected Jesus with, you know, different sets of insights than apparent in these early chapters of John 13, 14, 15, and so on, when the paraclete is promised. So I just want to talk about briefly, Josh, the way in which the dialogue gospel, as this genre is called, of which we have several examples after the time of the New Testament and maybe during the time of the New Testament, comes out of this framework of material. In other words, as people began to think about ways in which they might reflect upon the significance of Jesus and Jesus' appearances and Jesus in terms of revelation, both physical, both tactile, tangible, and also auditory, that all of that will be continued in this genre of material, the dialogue gospels.
What are some examples of those?
Well, the Epistle of the Apostles is called Epistula Apostolorum. This is a dialogue gospel amongst Jesus and all the apostles. That's one example. That's a collective thing, so it doesn't have to be with an individual disciple. The Gospel of Mary is a dialogue between Jesus and Mary, and it's building on John 20, of course, But I've been reading a very interesting dissertation that argues that Mary, in the Gospel of Mary, who is offering consolation to the disciples after the departure and the apparent increasing sense of Jesus' absence, Mary functions as a paraclete figure. So that this Gospel of Mary is building on the imagery of John's Gospel, the dialogue framework, and the portrait of Mary offering consolation, as the paraclete does, promises that everything will be recalled, and the presence of strength and encouragement to go out and proclaim the gospel to the world. So the Gospel of Mary would be another example of resurrection dialogue. I can list more, but that gives you a flavor.
Right.
Isn't that exciting? It's
yes,
very exciting to me.
Yes. So these would continue the kind of exchanges that are happening here in the Gospels outside of the canonical context, but they record the experiences of others in recognizing Jesus, and they can be they can be tactile, they can be they're physical.
Yes.
And auditory, right?
Yes. Yes, they're physical and auditory, and they're dialogue, because the conception, the argument, the framework here, the structure here is that dialogue increases insight.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is crucial. It's absolutely crucial. You put dialogue in a post-resurrection context, and you've taken away historical limitations and framework. So, for example, in a 4th century Coptic dialogue called Pistis Sophia, Faith Wisdom, the disciples ask Jesus, why do you always speak in parables? Mm-hmm. So they're able to ask questions that they have not asked before, but they know that teaching in parables is normative for Jesus, but capable of misunderstanding, as we see from Mark 4. So they can ask questions in a different framework, in a different reality, and they can hope to hear solutions, enlightenment to issues that they have hitherto not fully comprehended.
Yeah, right.
Thomas. Thomas is, of course, the subject of our discussion. And there are Thomas texts that continue the life. I was confusing there the Nachleben, the afterlife, and the life of Thomas, the sort of history of the interpretation of Thomas. The Thomas tradition. There's not one Thomas figure. There's a Gospel of Thomas. There's the Acts of Thomas. There's the traditions about Thomas going to India, bringing the good news of Jesus to India,
right,
where we see the establishment of Thomasine Christianity. So Thomas, in the broadest possible sense, has a long afterlife once these traditions around Thomas have been examined and surfaced in John's Gospel.
Julian, I think this is just such a wonderful and illuminating insight that you have here. And it's such an insightful and attentive reading of Scripture. And it's a perfect example, I think, of the kinds of things that close readings reveal. It shows you, there's a way in which even what it is that your reading of this text reveals is something that's actually being talked about or communicated in this story. The things that you're taking for granted about what's here, when you hear the voice, it scrambles those categories and you see something altogether new that you didn't see before. That's how I feel about this reading. I feel like Thomas myself here with what you've revealed, I guess is what I mean. It helps me see this disciple better. It helps me to hear extraordinary things about the nature of Jesus's resurrection and his wounds. So thank you very much. I think it's just wonderful.
Isn't it true theologically, Josh? You're the theologian.
Yeah. I'd like to know what your if you can unscramble your mind just a little bit there to give us some theological reflections on the fly, that would be wonderful.
Well, I'm thinking what it makes me think about is the way in which we don't fit Jesus. When you encounter the word of the resurrected Christ, right? Him speaking, like this is the way that you put it about what everyone sees when he speaks to Thomas. And what occurs to me there is the way that, like, there's an ambiguity about who he is in relationship to the everyday standpoint of things, right? Like when he appears within our categories, it's ambiguous. But when we hear the voice, it's on everything else flips. all of a sudden, he makes sense of our world. It's not we make sense of how he fits into ours. And it becomes a situation where all of a sudden the wounds or the cross itself, which appears to be the death of all of this thing, the crushing of every hope. I mean, if there's one thing that Jesus embodies in Jesus's ministry, it's hope for the transformation of all of these wounds and these pains, and yet here comes the Roman Empire to crush that. You can't have that. That's not what this is meant to be. If there's going to be peace, it's going to be peace on our terms. And yet it just, that to hear the word of the crucified Jesus is to have that completely flipped around, to see that what this looks like when it's fit in those categories, it just doesn't work. But when we hear that voice, all of a sudden everything is different. This is a sign of victory, right? If you hear it and understand it, and that would depend, as you're saying, on what the world would look like, and it asks us to see what the world would look like if we see Jesus in the wounds of others. And how that changes everything.
Exactly. That's exactly right, Josh. That's very, very good.
One of the hymns I love, and I know people who know me think this is just mawkish and an old-fashioned hymn, is I Come to the Garden Alone. Mm-hmm. And there's a wonderful version of it sung by Mahalia Jackson. And what the hymn is all about is listening. It's listening. He walks with me and he talks with me and he tells me I am his own. So it's about an individual encounter. It's about walking and talking in the company of someone as dialogue, as recognition, as affirmation, as unique revelation emerges. And it's why it's such a powerful hymn for so many people in spite of appearing mawkish and sentimental.
Mm-hmm.
Josh, I was also wondering about Tillich and doubt.
The idea that, are you suggesting the idea that doubt is not the opposite of faith?
Yes. Yeah. I thought it would be useful.
Yeah.
I mean, really helpful if you explain that more.
Right. It's the idea that faith is about what it is that brings us into the fullest experience of ourselves, and there are different forms of faith that you can have. You can place your faith in different things insofar as they are understood to be the basis of what will bring you what will lead you to an authentic, true life, true self. And we are mistaken about those things. We put our trust in, you know, a career, or we put our trust in, and that may be another way of thinking about faith as trust, what you entrust yourself to, right? What, and mm-hmm. In the mm-hmm. sense of what will bring you fulfillment. And what I think is really great about Julian's reflection here is that she signals that Thomas had invested himself in Jesus, right? That's the point of the, mm-hmm. that let's go die for him if we need to. Mm-hmm. And that there's a sense of authenticity about who he is in relationship to mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. And as Tillich points out, though, that's not to say faith is not something that's set in opposition to doubt, in the sense of like, well, when you can't be certain about something, you doubt whether it's true, and so you just have faith. No, doubt is integral to what faith is in a certain sense, because it involves trust. you can't really know. And you are wrestling with what you don't know, but it has to do with, but nevertheless, you trust, you entrust yourself to something. And I think this is part of what I see kind of as a consequence, or as one of the things that Julian's sermon illuminates, is that, you know, Thomas had entrusted himself to who Jesus was and the his ministry, and finds himself distraught because all of that seemed to have crumbled around him. And then, you know, and they say he's risen, and he says, I won't, you know, I'm not going to believe that unless I put my hands in his wounds. And then he hears the voice. And that's all the more fulfilling to him because he had given himself to it, and then he sees that it lives, that it is still alive. The doubting part of that is not a contradiction of it at all. It's part of the process of continuing to believe in the circumstances in which it looks like all is lost.
I think that's so important, Josh. I want to thank you so much for making that clear. More doubt is what we need, I think, not less. Julian, have you said everything you want to say?
I think for me, part of what is kind of miraculous is the various ways that we can recognize people we love. Mm. The face is so often not what we need, not the first thing we see. When we see somebody from a distance, we see something completely different. We see a stance, we see a walk, we see a particular tilt of the head, we see, oh, all kinds of things, a hand gesture. And I think it's that's part of what happens with these recognitions of Jesus. Jesus gives us what we need to recognize him. Not sure what else I can say about that.
Mm-hmm. I think what we do here is simply explore different aspects of the text and theological ideas around the text. And then we hope that we have come up with enough different sorts of ideas that people will be able to preach their own insights mm-hmm. And teach, you know, their own words with regard to these readings for Easter too. That's what we hope to do. Okay, I'm going to end this. Josh, is there anything else you want to say?
No, just thank you. Thank you, Julian.
Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Thank you, Julian.
I'm happy to be part of. Thank you so much for
so
inviting me to join you on this.
Now you can see what a magical mystery tour this is.
This is a magical mystery tour.
Wonderful, Josh. Thank you so much. Really appreciate being with you.
Okay. Good to be with you.
And continuing Easter greetings to everyone.
Oh, thank you. Yes, you too.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.